and good afternoon. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is your host, Jeff Bryant, on Now You're Talking. Later in the show, Keith Kennedy will be here, but in the meantime, this week I had the chance to talk to Adam Schell. Adam is a Vancouver-based photographer and represents one half of the award-winning duo Adam and Kev. Adam and Kev recently released a coffee table book containing portraits of Vancouver residents called So It Is Vancouver. We talked about the book, we talked about Playground, a video project that showcased bands collaborating musically with their audience. We also talked about what it's like to be a photographer in the age of the iPhone. Learn more about the book at soitisvancouver.com. Here it is, my conversation with Adam Schell.
It's a coffee table book, and the idea behind it is that we want this book to exist on coffee tables, beside toilets, on bookshelves, next to beds, in the old cabin up by the lake.
I appreciate that of the list you're offering, it began with toilets. Is that's the preferred placement of the book?
I don't know if it's preferred. I just think it's one of those places that people put books.
It's and a captive audience, right?
Yeah, and I'm wise to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's meant to be enjoyed piecemeal.
All right.
But it could also be, you know, you could sit down next to a fireplace with a nice sipping scotch or whatever your pleasure is, and just go all the way through and flip all the way through the book. And ultimately, it's a book about the people, culture, and history of Vancouver. And it's told through 95 portraits and with small written bits that go along with it, with each portrait.
And there's a lot of names people will recognize, like famous, notable Vancouverites, but also some names that they might not recognize, right?
Exactly, and that was the goal. Like, by no means is this book meant to be the who's who of Vancouver or any kind of elite list. It's certainly not exhaustive. And the idea is that we wanted to represent the diversity of Vancouver, and ultimately everyone in the book is remarkable in one way or another. We've got billionaires, Chip and Shannon Wilson, the Lululemon founders and designers that started that company, and you got Dave Suzuki, you've got Dr. Julio Montana, the man who has essentially changed the face of living with AIDS and HIV, and he's based out of St. Paul. So you've got these names and people that have achieved a lot, and then on the other end of the scale, you've got you got people that you wouldn't have heard of, but within their own stories are remarkable with what they've done as well. And so, I mean, that's Vancouver. It's not just about the exciting big names. It's made up of all types of people, right?
And if you take a look at the book, there's a lot of people. It's close to 100. Is that right?
Well, there's 95 portraits. And
95 portraits.
I don't know exactly how many people are in the book. And the reason I say that is because some of the portraits have one person, some of them have two,
mm-hmm.
and some of them are... even there's bigger groups. So I've never actually done the math, but there's 95 portraits.
So how long did it take you to shoot 95 portraits? That sounds like it would take some time.
Yeah, it did take some time. And so when I keep referring to we, and so we would be myself and my business partner, Kev Holloway, a lovely little Englishman who I've shared a business with for the last 8.5 years.
I sense that Kev might be true. I thought maybe he likes his preferred personal pronoun is we, or maybe he has an English partner.
Yeah, as it happens, your second guess was accurate.
I could have gone either way.
Yeah, it could have. So little Kevy Holloway is the other half of Adam and Kev Photography. And so we've been... As I said, we've been in business for 8.5 years, and you spend a lot of time with your business partner through those years. And you're constantly batting back ideas, and as you get inspired by certain things. And I think over the last 5 years, we've been very focused on exploring our creative inspirations into projects. And so this we talked about for probably about 4 years. And then 2 years ago, we actually started to kick it into gear, shape it a little bit more as a concept, and begin shooting. And so I'd actually like, I should do the math and find out exactly how many people we shot in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
For this book, because it wasn't loads. It was probably like between 10 and 15 portraits. And then moving into 2015, we started to ramp it up more. And then the summer, last summer, 2015, we did a Kickstarter campaign, which finished September 2nd. And then our deadline for print was, I think, the end of October. So basically September, October, we shot close to 45 portraits. So we did the bulk of it we did at least half of it in about 2.5 months. And that was crazy. So Kevin and I were in business, as I said, about 8.5 years ago we started. And probably about 2.5 years into the business, we were a little bit disillusioned with the type of work and the caliber of work that we were getting. And we weren't feeling inspired by what we were doing or happy. And so we made a conscious effort to only start taking on work that we were inspired by. And then also we just started to pursue creative projects. And so out of that came this project called Playground, which was a live music event series. It sort of really took place over about 3 years. And the concept was that we take a band and an audience, and we put them in a venue that's not a typical music venue, and we fit it out with music and sound recording equipment. So essentially it becomes like a makeshift recording studio. And then we have this event where there's free beer, the entry is free for the audience, and there's one challenge for the night, and that is for the band and the audience to collaborate on one piece of music, and get it good, like collaborate for an hour or so that they can play it together, and then we record it all and turn it into a music video.
Get it good, but I mean, it's really get it as good as it can be and sort of see what happens, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. It was always, There was always a risk of, this is not going to happen.
And it seemed like that was actually one of the things that made it fun and interesting for people, was the sort of, it was kind of daring in that way. And everybody, because the audience was involved collaboratively, there was the possibility it would be a train wreck. And that kind of made it exciting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It made it terrifying at times too. But I mean, yeah, the fun thing about it was that it really happened just through sheer will of like, this is a cool concept. Let's just run with it. And we tried to be as organized as we can. And I think what a big part of that was, like, Kevin, I recognize we are not the best at what needs, you know, the skill sets that need to be involved in this. So we collaborated with other people to sort of make up the Playground team, from videographers to, you know, planners to sound engineers. And so the first event sort of happened, and it was really just kind of grassrootsy. And then we did another one, and then there was another one. Eventually we did 11 all up. On our fifth one in, we landed funding from TELUS Optic Local, the local TV programming side of the TELUS brand. And they ended up funding six more events
that were subsequently televised, right, or available to watch if you're a TELUS customer, however that works.
Exactly. And we put them online as well, but they were sort of formatted for the TELUS Optic on demand.
It's interesting because both these projects, I mean, I'm sure there's people who are out there that are artists who are wondering how to cross the threshold from aspiring to create work, but, you know, there's, you know, it feels like there's funding that needs to be involved and wondering how to bridge that gap. And for you guys, you have two examples now of where you kind of started these projects on blind faith and hoped that by creating something that showed promise and having sort of a proof of concept that you would be able to discover that possibility. And that's happened twice with TELUS as you're describing here, and then Kickstarter for the book that we mentioned before.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the lesson there? I mean, I think that for a lot of people, they'd listen to this and wonder, you know, I think I hear that, and I think that that would take a lot of guts, and I'm sure a lot of people would agree. So what have you learned from those experiences that's informed you as a artist slash, you know, entrepreneur?
It's tough because I feel like we had a certain amount of luck in both those projects. But at the same time, I guess that wasn't everything. I don't know. I guess the advice would be just follow through. I think that was, when I think back to Playground, that was kind of one of the mantras, was just, let's just do it. Let's just give it a shot. And, you know, and to be fair, we actually tried a few other things before it came to its sort of like incarnation that worked. There's a few failures, but I guess once you recognize something was working and we were committed to set the date, make it happen. And I guess allow ourselves to be, I mean, for me, that's a big part of art in general, is just that it's so about the process. I feel like the quality of the work is going to be whether other people enjoy it or not. And so you need to be able to back that up, I think, if you're going to take it anywhere. But a big part of it is the process and what you learn and the problems that you have to solve throughout it.
Yeah, and really, for me, it's like just like putting yourself out there. I mean, that would be my sort of interpretation of the experience you guys have had. It's like you mentioned the word luck, and that's going to play a role to some degree, and maybe it played a role to a large degree in the case of both those projects. But for me, the point is that if you hadn't put yourself out there in the first place, the luck wouldn't have been able to intersect with what you're doing. So, I mean, I think for a lot of people, they struggle to take those first steps because they want some assurances. And in each case, I've noticed as I've watched you guys do these projects that you just kind of went for it. And I don't think it was naive that you're like, oh, I'm sure it'll take care of itself. You know, you did what you could to try to create the possibility of luck.
Yeah, I think so. I think I would agree with that, too. Because it's not like all of a sudden, you know, I won a lotto ticket or I won some award and like there was a genie and then, you know, that was my award. I get one of those bottles with a genie in it.
Let's talk about how you became a photographer in the first place. What got you moving down this road? Because I'm always interested to hear from people why they, you know, set out to do something there's not a lot of people making a living as an artist, you know? And so I'm interested to hear what compelled you to move in that direction, like whenever that started.
Thanks, man. This is an interesting question. I find it interesting myself just because it's not like I ever had this sort of like real crazy passion for photography. Mm-hmm. I wish I could say I did, you know, like, you know, you read the photographer's bio and it's like, well, I got my first camera when I was 12 and I knew at that point.
He emerged from the womb and he took an incredible Polaroid pic.
Exactly. Like for me, I guess my father was into photography. He always had a 35 millimeter SLR film camera and he was at all the family events. But and you know what? Probably more over than any of like just seeing him just snapping photos was the fact that there were actually like prints of his, some like beach scenes, like just kind of like landscape shots. But they were good. And actually, when I think about them, they're good photos. And seeing that, I guess was an influence, a bigger influence than probably I've given him credit for, or have even thought about giving him that credit. And so, just seeing that photography as a medium is more than just sort of like the snap side of thing. There's a result. So I guess that played a part of the role. And then a friend of mine who, he's one of those friends, his name's Trevor Undy. He's one of those friends that's just like dripping in creative artistic talent and ability. it's sort of anything that he tries or puts his hands onto definitely is just really well done. And he was actually one of the first people that kind of got me. He was into, you know, in high school, he got in maybe grade 11 or 12. He had a camera, film camera. And then I got one and just kind of played around with it a little bit. And I guess and that was kind of really all it was. And I think, I don't know what it's like for other people, but as I was sort of getting into my 20s and trying to figure out what the hell I'm doing with my life, I was quite lost, actually, when I think about it. And the idea of trying to make a living as a photographer seemed terrifying. But at the same time, I found myself just finding opportunity. There was an opportunity that kind of presented itself while I was living in the UK, in London. And a friend said, hey, Addie, I just saw this job advertised for someone they need like someone to work at this studio. And you're into photography, aren't you? And so that friend just kind of like suggested this ad, and I went and applied for this job, and I became one of the assistants at the studio. And I guess really like that, I owe that friend, Pauly Green, I guess a lot, really, because I guess what I'm trying to say is like, there was never a massive amount of like a clear vision of that I wanted to be a photographer. I kind of just, out of feeling lost, decided, well, I may as well just choose something I'm kind of interested in to just get a job for now.
And when your friend said to you, hey, you're a photographer, aren't you? You were like, yeah, I guess I am. You're willing to say, yeah, okay, yeah, I am.
Yeah, I
guess
so.
That could have been a moment where you're like, oh, I don't know, I'm thinking about it, but I need more time to contemplate it.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good point. That actually kind of makes me feel good about the fact that despite the fact that I was feeling very lost and uncertain about what I wanted out of life and a career and stuff, I still had the fortitude to say, yeah, I'm going to go for that and put myself on the line. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of how my story began. And then I guess I just continued down that path, eventually studied it. And when I returned to Vancouver and studied it for 2 years, and that gave me a stronger foundation in the technical side of things. And then just started assisting more photographers here in Vancouver and did some internships in LA and Toronto. And yeah, I guess gradually sort of built up confidence and eventually met my Englishman, Kev Holloway.
I love that he's yours. He belongs to you.
My little Englishman.
Do you belong to him equally, or how does that work?
No, not at all.
What's the state of photography in 2016? Obviously, photography has been digital for some time, and I know that you went to school at a time when there probably was still film happening, and it was in transition. So in 2016, like, describe to me where we're at with photography as far as, you know, the essential service that it is for somebody to be an expert in photography versus everybody has an iPhone and they take pretty good pictures. What's that like for you as a photographer in 2016?
Well, I mean, I think, everything's digital these days. There's probably niche photographers that will still shoot film. I'm sure there's still some fashion stuff and some, really high-end portrait photography that is still shot on film. And to be honest, I enjoy film and I'll always experiment and explore film just because as an aesthetic, but generally it's a digital world, and what that allows is people to, you know, it allows the everyday person with a camera and that has successfully photographed a bunch of things, bunch of snaps and holidays and whatever, to feel like they can put themselves into a position as a professional to make money from it. And I guess the big difference is it's one thing to be able to consistently take good photos of stuff as they happen. And I think what sets the professional photographers apart is the ability to produce imagery based on a desired outcome.
Right. So there's capturing candid photography or casually assembling your friends into a pyramid on the beach. But there's still the art form of artfully putting people into a pyramid on the beach or wherever. It's the conceptual stuff versus just on the fly.
Exactly. And so, like, as a professional, to be a professional photographer, that means that you're getting paid to take photographs, right? And so whether that means you're just photographing, families or dogs or you're photographing, for advertising agencies, which are working for companies and businesses. At the end of the day, whatever it is that however it is you're getting paid to photograph these things, you need to be able to get your client what it is that they want. And so that's what I think the more experience and the more technical experience and know-how that you have allows you to be better at consistently delivering quality imagery.
And does it work both ways with digitization, like in the sense that are photographs being consumed way more than ever before, and in a way that offsets the availability of digital cameras? Are more images being consumed because it's not just print, but in people's everyday lives, they're constantly, is there more imagery floating around? Is that a good thing for photographers? More opportunities for professional
shoots?
Yeah,
I don't know. It's tricky. I don't really know. Because on one hand, yeah, there's imagery, everywhere, because we go onto Facebook and there's ads on the side, and there's, people's even, like, with the way Facebook works, it brings up, hey, you've been a member for 5 years and celebrate by posting these photos again. And so, photos do have more of a way to be showcased. But in some ways, I almost feel that despite that, people often don't do a lot with their photos. There's a lot of people that have really nice cameras, and they'll take a lot of photos, and maybe they'll make it onto Facebook. I think it's really important to do something with your photos, which is kind of what led to us making this book too, as purely from an artistic, as an artist, as a photographer. That is something that, Kev and I wanted to create, something that would last and has the ability to get old on a desk or a bookshelf.
Right. It must feel nice to have the physical book, because it's an attractive book. It looks great. So it must be nice to be able to share that and to physically hand it to somebody.
Yeah. It feels
or throw it at them. I mean, don't get me wrong. It doesn't have to be handed to them politely. I don't know how you share things with people.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's nice to have all the options.
Mm-hmm. Just dish it out.
Yeah.
Should get, like, one of those, like, at sporting events, they have, like, the T-shirt cannon. You should get the So It Is Vancouver cannon. And just,
so,
like,
just for context, it's like a 12-inch by 9-inch, 240-page hardcover book.
Yeah.
So we... So the idea that you're proposing is we, like, launch that, many of these, into crowds just in general.
It could be crowds. It could be like a drive-by situation.
Classrooms.
I don't know. Maybe if you got a very sophisticated machine, you could shoot it at people's coffee tables.
I mean, I think that would be the ideal. You know what I mean?
That could be the new distribution model. People talk, I know that there's technologies being explored for drones delivering mail in the future, or Amazon's exploring, but forget that. That's not, it's kind of like sometimes you want to leapfrog technology and just cut to the chase. And I think that if you had a machine that took the item and delivered it to where it lives, that's more sophisticated. So how about a machine?
Well, what about this?
Go on.
You got this book cannon strapped to a drone.
Nice. It's inevitable.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. It's got to have the drone. It's just, rather than putting it on the front porch, put it where it belongs.
Yeah.
Put it on the coffee table.
Right through the open window. just slips it right in there. It lands just nicely beside or on the coffee table.
I'm excited about what that could do for sales for you guys if you could explore that technology. Of course, you'd need to do another Kickstarter campaign to create that technology.
Do you think we could just like open it up to the audience right now just to be like
be
the listeners? I guess it's just like if anyone has the know-how and or the technology and or you know, the capital to make this happen.
Get it going.
Reach out. Yeah.
Make it happen. And if somebody follows through on that and proves it can be done and it's all put together, would you give them a free copy of the book?
Well, you know, I don't like to talk about like the deep ins and outs of business deals. Like we'll have to leave that to the, you know, the business deal at the time.
Maybe a discount?
Yeah. I'm sure it's safe to say they could get a discount.
All right. Okay. Well, you heard it, folks. If
and maybe they'd get a book.
They get a book. So I don't want to close. It's not guaranteed, but they might get a book. If they do maybe get it, it will definitely be discounted, but it's not clear how much the discount will be, is I think what I'm hearing here.
Correct.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a lot of incentive for a lot of hard work that may or may not result in anything, but that kind of brings us back to the theme of your exploration of the arts, which is just get started, give it a whirl, hope for the best, and maybe you'll have some luck along the way.
Yeah.
Adam, thank you for talking.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
So that was my guest, Adam Schell. Adam, thanks for the opportunity to chat. If you want to learn more about his book, check it out at soitisvancouver.com. And my next guest is Keith Kennedy. Keith lives here in Vancouver. He is a published poet and writer of fiction, an option screenwriter, and a novelist. You can check out his daily humor blog, Ask Keith Anything, by Googling Ask Keith Anything. Keith, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
It's good to have you back. We were in here last week doing the fill-in show.
Yes, we were.
Now we're doing the real show.
Yep.
Now we're talking on Now We're Talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just started talking and now we're talking.
We're doing it.
Yeah.
So you're a writer. I know that, but the audience is just learning that as we go. One thing I wanted to talk to you about today is just understanding the discipline that goes into writing, because I know that you essentially write every single day.
Yeah.
So can you explain to me and to the listeners, how does that work? How do you find the motivation to write daily?
That's a good question, because motivation is the thing that stops a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of trick myself. It's about habit forming, I think. And I think a lot of people don't realize the power of just doing something repetitively. And the best way to do it is to start small. Like if you just clean your shower or something. I think it's an adage I heard once. If you clean your shower every single day after you finish, or make your bed, that kind of thing.
Then establish the habit.
You do it for like 30 days, and the day after that.
Right. Initially, it's difficult to the point of seeming impossible. But if you can overcome that initial hurdle.
Yeah.
It's interesting you describe it that way, because it kind of makes it analogous to the things people aim to do, you know, at the beginning of a new year, like lose weight or stay in touch with their friends better or whatever, which is things people say that they're going to do and want to do, but don't do it, and they wonder why. And it's definitely got to be the same thing with writing, where people might have that ambition, but to actually make the commitment. So was there a period in your writing career where you had to get over that sort of 30-day hump?
Yeah. I read Stephen King's On Writing, which I will not be the only person to speak the praises of.
Yeah.
It's a writer's Bible for a lot of modern writers.
Yeah.
Because it's so matter-of-fact in the way it's delivered, all the lessons of how to be a writer. And it's one of the things that he suggests is write 1,000 words a day. And so I thought, that's not a lot.
It's I can
like
do that.
Making your bed. And as I said before, if you do something long enough, the day you don't do it, something feels wrong.
And did you specify whether they need to be 1,000 distinct words, or could it just be
I think
the same word over and over?
Specifically the same word as much as you can.
Specifically the word specifically 1,000 times. Just like I can just see somebody taking that and like, I can do this.
I can do
and they're
it.
Just writing the word specifically over and over, thinking that it's getting them closer. Soon I'll be published
I've written a novel. Guess what it's called?
It may or may not be called specifically with forward by specifically.
Yeah.
Because I remember there was a period like 5 or 6 or so years ago where you had been writing for a number of years with you were prolific in my mind, but you took it to yet another level. And I think it was this output specifically of if I do 1,000 words a day times X amount of days, I can begin to write novels.
Yeah, so the truth is that I wasn't prolific. I was living the very typical lifestyle. And in no means of way, I won't insult anybody out there who's striving to be an artist.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't realize just how much actual work it is, how much, you know, butt in the seat, do it work. And so I was a casual worker in that regard. And just like a lot of us, I couldn't find the motivation to do it all the time.
Did you realize that at the time or now in retrospect?
Yeah, I think for a long time, I felt like a pretender. And I didn't know why until I started being a professional and doing it every single day, despite how I was feeling. There's no muse, right? Again, people can believe what they want to, but you catch the muse. You start yourself and hopefully the muse shows up. I don't believe in it at all. I think it's work. It's like fixing a car.
Yeah,
you learn the tools, and then you open the hood, and you fix the bloody car.
Yeah, it's interesting how you. I think I'm guilty of this. You can romanticize what the path will be, but if you're not doing it consistently, whether it's romantic or not romantic, it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. And let me tell you something about romance. It's a lot sweeter when you feel a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
Right? When you get that thing done that day, when I write the blog or I write the 1,000 words for a book, I feel like I did something. I really did. And we talked about this off air that I've read 1,000 words and that seems like, well, that's not much. But you do that for 2 months, 3 months. An average novel is 60,000 to 100,000 words. So I write a book every 3 months, maybe four.
Right, every quarter or so.
Yeah, I write about three a year.
Wow.
By baby stepping.
Wow. You know,
1,000 words is not a lot, right? It's like a couple of pages on your computer, maybe a little bit less.
You're making me feel like this radio show should be daily and not weekly.
Yeah.
You know, I assume here at CITR, the name of the game is it's just a given you do a weekly show.
Yeah.
But maybe the outcome of this interview is I will request to do the show daily, or if I really wanted to get prolific, hourly.
Yeah. Well, it's going to take you 7 times longer to make this a habit.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you think about it that way, I realize how lazy I'm being right now.
Yeah, we're being incredibly lazy. We're sitting.
Yeah. And you're sitting, we're talking once a week. This is good. This is good. I feel like I'm proud of myself for getting started, but I'm realizing how.
Yeah. Well, I definitely don't want to discourage people. And what it comes down to is that I had as much trouble as you would imagine someone would have when I started. But the feeling of doing it. I mean, day 3, you feel good. Day 10, you feel amazing. And on day 31, it's a necessity. You have to write because you will not get that satisfaction if you don't. And I did that for 4 years. 4 years I wrote every single day, birthdays, Christmas, just to make sure it was nailed in. And not everyone has to go that far. But once you get the discipline and realize how beneficial it is, don't be surprised if you work a lot.
Yeah.
Right? That's how you do. You teach yourself how to work. And I was very unmotivated when I was younger. This was a pipe dream that I never should have pursued with my personality at the age of 21. To say I'm going to be a professional writer was lunacy.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to learn how to do it. And now that I'm doing it this way, I feel really comfortable and excited even to tell people, especially young people, if you're 19 or 20, don't spend 5 years faking it. Do the work. You'll get better that much faster in anything you do, right? But art specifically, make sure you're working at your art.
Yeah.
That's what makes great art.
It's funny how you could offer that advice just as somebody could have offered it to you when you were 21, let's say.
And I wouldn't have heard
them. And you wouldn't have heard them. It's
well,
like you've got to have your own experience.
Yeah.
I mean, so hopefully if you keep hearing it, it'll be vaguely available to you as a concept.
Yeah.
But it's funny the things you wish you'd known sooner and you realize, yeah, but I had to go through whatever I went through to get there.
That's one of my favorite adages is the idea that you know an idea is good when you feel foolish for not having had it sooner.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So how many novels, and we talked before about how there's different formats of writing you've done, but specifically novels, how many have you written by now with this approach?
Well, let me do the math. I don't know exactly. I feel strange talking about it because it just seems like a lot for someone who, you know, isn't famous for doing it. I mean,
sure.
I've written more than famous people and less than others. Everyone's different, but
But it feels like, based on what you've said, this is the way to maybe get to that by being prolific.
There's two sort of kinds of approaches to this sort of writing, I think, which is you write a book or two, and then you work very hard at making them good enough. Quotes good enough, because I'm not sure I understand what that means. Some people seem to, and they go that route. I'm the other kind of writer who writes a different thing every time, and hopefully I'm getting better at the format itself. So by writing, you know, 10, 12, 15 novels in a row, I'm not making the first one better, but that 15th one could be very, very good. And because of the way the business works, where I'm sending them out into the world, it's important to me to have a new product that's the best of me, but also original,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you're not sure. You know what it's like to rework something over and over again to the point where you go, do I stop now? When do I stop? When is it good enough?
Yeah.
So I just set a rule. I said, I'll do this many drafts. I'll do three or four, depending on the project. And that's it.
Well, you've hit on something there that, for me, there's a number of reasons why I admire you hanging in there with what you do, because one of the challenges as a writer is it's got to be very difficult to know what that point is. For example, with a podcast, it will go out and that's done.
Yeah.
Like, we will have this conversation.
Yeah.
This will go on the internet. People will like it or not, but mm-hmm. that's definitely done. And then we move on to the next one. And in a way, you're getting the best of both worlds, because on a weekly, which should be a daily basis.
Yeah, we're working on that, ladies and gentlemen.
You're getting something out there. You're potentially getting feedback, or at least yourself, you're getting a sense of, am I happy with it, am I not? And it will grow, and you'll get a quote-unquote body of work over time. And same thing for me. This is a new experience for me with podcasting and being on the radio, but I'm thinking more of my experience as a performer, as a songwriter, as a musician, where you get to gig. So that seems like one of the challenges of being a writer is it's an isolated experience.
Very much
creating
so.
It. And unless you're at the top of the heap, you're not necessarily getting a lot of feedback.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yet you're a happy guy. Like, it feels like you're a pretty happy person. It feels like you should be much more miserable than you are.
Thank you for noticing how miserable I should be. It's very insightful what you're saying, because you do. I write little things. It's funny because I get a little bit of feedback here and there. So if I publish poetry, if I publish short fiction, of course, that's a pat on the back. But as someone who really wants to be a novelist and works very hard at larger projects, I do. I write a book. And in the back of my head, someone goes, yay. And then I put it on a stack.
Yeah.
And I hope that when I get around to getting that one polished and out in the world, that's the one
mm-hmm.
that gets me over that hump.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a strange feeling. I find myself, I'll call a few people, like, hey, mom, I finished on my new book. She'll be very encouraging, and I'll take as much of that as I can.
Yeah.
But my mind's already moving on to the next thing. Because, like, as I mentioned before, my philosophy is to just do the next thing. Start at the next one right away. Get better at the format.
I'm just being reminded of another thing we've talked about before, which occurs to me is, again, if you're a musician, you can record a song, put it on YouTube, see if people like whatever.
Yeah.
When you're a writer, it's not the same thing, especially if you're writing novels. It's like, you don't just throw up a chapter in a PDF format and people will go viral.
Yeah. Well, you can. I mean, sort of self-publish.
And maybe there are things to explore if you're daring.
Yeah.
But much more, I would say, than music or... I don't know, comedy or lots of different other realms of being an artist. It feels like it's still the historical conventional model of get an agent helps you get it published. Like that still seems to be in place much more than, for example, with music, the model of, get signed, to a multi-record deal. That's totally changed.
Yeah.
It's different with writing. It's totally different.
Yeah, I mean, there is self-publishing, and there's people who like to do that and people who should do that. And especially the kind of people who are very good at understanding how to market and the other side of it. I am very much a typical, I want to say talent. That's a terrible word to use because I'm not implying my talent in particular. But I'm the kind of person
that creates the
content. Yeah, I want to be the talent.
Yeah.
I aspire to be someone who doesn't have to deal with all those other things.
Yeah.
Which is kind of selfish and strange. I get why that may seem weird. I'm just terrible at the other side of it. I'm terrible at the business side of it, as you know.
Well,
we've talked about this.
If not terrible, it's just I can understand. It's, if you clearly have a propensity for this, it's intuitive to think if I could collaborate with a person or the people that do the other thing, it will just be more efficient.
Yeah, which is what an agent does.
Yeah, so that could be a rationalization. But it's also, there's something to it, and I know that from collaborating with different people and really thinking about how can I have everybody doing the thing that they do best so this will be greater than the sum of all parts.
And I think that's maybe what I'm aspiring to do, is to get good enough that I really am that guy, that I really am the guy who does the writing part the best. And then hopefully things will fall into place. But my instinct is to just keep working hard at the craft. And I'm trying to open my mind, of course, to some of these other things. I mean, just being here on the radio with you is an interesting facet of that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm happy to have you here today and hopefully to have you a part of the show moving forward, mm-hmm. is because I've said to you, it's like, you're a writer and a speaker. And I mean, if anybody, if you know Keith, he's from Newfoundland, so right away. But also just the way that you're built, regardless of where you're from.
Yeah.
You're a speaker. And when you're a writer, it feels like half the battle. So that's why I'm glad to have you here, because it's an opportunity, hopefully on a weekly basis, mm-hmm. for us to be speaking.
For me to get to flex that muscle. Because I agree. I think I chose a path, and the idea that some of the other things I can do, which, you know, I don't know how many of them I can do, but
you can find out.
You know, I thought for a long time that I had to focus narrowly on one thing, and that's why the blog was a really big deal for me about 5 years ago when I started that.
Yeah,
was getting, again, like you said, the gratification a little bit. Write something funny, people think it's funny. They say, "Good job, it's funny," and also trying something different, exercising the humor muscle a bit more, which in epic fantasy novels, for example. Not so much.
Well, and that blog, Ask Keith Anything, we're going to get to that later in the show, where we're going to do the first ever radio version of Ask Keith Anything. But first, I also know about you, Keith, that you're a huge football fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not just a fan. Like, football has been a big part of your life. Yeah. By football, I mean soccer, by which I mean football.
Yes.
And I was wondering, this is kind of going out on a limb. I don't want to be presumptuous. Yeah. Would you consider, I'm thinking about different ways for you to be involved in the show, right?
Okay, yeah.
I'm glad that we're talking here in sort of interview context, but I'd like you to stick around moving forward.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what if you assume the role of a sort of man on the scene football correspondent? I know Euro Cup's going on, Copa America's going on. Is that something you'd be into?
Yeah, I would.
Let's give it a shot. You know what, Keith? Let's do Ask Keith Anything instead. You know, I think we could do the Euro Cup thing, but I'm feeling like that's meant to happen later in the show.
Okay.
I'm optimistic that that could be a thing. So why don't we just dive in with a new segment, folks? It's called Ask Keith Anything. Why don't you tell the folks a little bit about your blog?
Sure. So as I was just saying, I started about 5 years ago. It's a humor blog where I chose to get people to ask me questions. I wasn't sure what the content should be when I started, and I didn't want to commit to anything because at that stage in my life, I hadn't learned some of these lessons about discipline and habit forming. And so I thought, if I could make other people create the content for me, basically, by having them ask me the questions, then I could just riff. It would just be like being in a room with someone, with your friend, and you can just do your thing and rant. And so that became the format.
Nice. Beautiful. Well, let me see if I can get the, let's dive into it, and let's talk about what's the theme for this week. What do we got? What's the question for this week?
Okay. So the question this week is from, Jocelyn in Kelowna.
Jocelyn in Kelowna.
Yeah. And the question is, what are the worst places, the top five, sorry, it says top five worst places to break up with someone.
Top five worst places to break up with somebody. Okay, let's hear it. Number five.
Okay, so the first one we got is a deserted island.
Deserted island.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I figured most likely in a deserted island situation, you're one of the only people there. And the other person there would be someone that you wouldn't want to be on the outs with, especially if it was a situation where you had been romantic with them or had considered at all that you might want to resort to eating them for sustenance. So there just isn't a great way to get away from someone when you're the only person there. They're the only person there, and you probably have to sleep near each other and bathe in the same pond and all those sorts of things.
That makes sense. And number four?
Four, I've got a jazz club. So in no way do I want to insult jazz fans. That is not the intention here, but jazz has always just absolutely baffled me. I am a fan of music, and I learned a little bit about the math of it, but there's an evil genius thing going on with jazz musicians where they are just wrestling with all of this creativity, and yet, you know, the ballet and the phone booth thing, which I heard just recently, which I love as a metaphor for creativity, where they have this incredible structure. And so the problem there is that what are the chances, if you're breaking up with someone at a jazz club, that you or the person you're with, either one of you, is understanding at all what's going on? So as it is, you're pretending. You're in that situation and you're not sure that you should be there. And then the music is kind of syncopated and random in a way where it's hard to pick your spot, and just the mood is dark. I mean, I guess for sneaking out, it's good. But if you really want to fess up and, you know, break up with someone, no jazz club.
And speaking of music, it's time for Ask Keith Anything. That's right, folks. You can fax it in. You can mail it in. You can give us a call. You could even send over a mule. As long as there's a question for Keith to answer, that's pretty much the deal. Go ahead and ask Keith anything, and he'll answer it to the best of his ability. It could be hilarious. It could be forlorn. Too soon to say. But here we go. This week's edition of Ask Keith Anything. Yes, folks, if you're just joining us, this is CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant, also the engineer for the show. Show's called Now We're Talking. I have Keith in studio. Keith,
yeah.
I did the best I could to try to troubleshoot while maintaining my role as host.
Yes, good
There's
job.
A lot of moving parts in here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first episode, and I've got a lot of knobbies I'm twirling and
yep.
flipping and switches and all this stuff. I was very excited to go into the one of our segments, and there was no output from my computer.
Right.
So what I managed to do was go in the other room, troubleshoot, restart my computer.
Nice work.
Now it works. And folks, that was the theme song for Ask Keith Anything. We mentioned earlier in the show, Keith has a blog called Ask Keith Anything. You can find it on the internet by Googling Ask Keith Anything. And like we said there in the song, the theme music for the segment, if you want to, you know what you can do? There's multiple ways. You can do the mule, you can do the fax, whatever you want. But let's just say, go on Twitter, at R. Keith Kennedy, or just look up Ask Keith Anything, but at R. Keith Kennedy.
Yeah.
Send a tweet, ask Keith a question, and he'll answer it next week. But coming back to what we were at here, we've done number 5 and number 4.
Yep.
We're talking about the top 5 worst places to break up with somebody. Number 5 was?
The deserted island.
The deserted island. And number 4 was?
The jazz club.
Now we're moving on to number 3. Number 3, what do we got?
You guys, you ever been to, I said you guys, like I'm going to ask all the people out
you
there
guys.
In Radioland.
Sure.
And then we'll just wait for them to call us back.
You can say you guys rhetorically.
Do you know the do-it-yourself pottery places? I know there's do-it-yourself art places as
right.
well, but my specific experience was at a do-it-yourself pottery place. So
sure.
this is a place where you go in.
Well, right away it makes me think of the movie Ghost.
Yeah, of course.
Right? That famous scene.
Of course.
That famous scene.
Which we should probably keep in the back of our minds.
For sure.
This
it could be useful.
Tonally very exciting.
Yes.
What you do at these places is you pick some sort of pottery and then you paint it yourself. And then they fire it. And it's a terrible
in
place.
In the kiln.
Yeah, in the kiln. Good word. It's a terrible place to be / have to break up with someone because it's similar to the jazz club idea. You're not good at what you're doing. You're not getting it. Unless you're in this very small minority, you don't know how to pot or whatever the purpose
you're not
for
a potter.
Pottery.
Yeah.
You obviously also don't know how to paint. And so what happens is you're excited in the beginning, and it becomes almost a metaphor for the relationship that you're trying to get out of, where you start painting your underwater scene, and you're like, okay, green for seaweed, that doesn't quite look right. And then you try to do a fish, and that's horrible. And you realize that this is just terrible, and you have to take it home. You're paying $40 for it. You don't want it. And then you have to turn to this person and say that you don't want them.
And also, it's true. And also, you never want to break up with somebody where there's a kiln nearby. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you've ever dated a witch in particular,
yeah.
always be away from open flame.
So let's just say no arts and crafts.
No arts and crafts, no witch dating.
Number 2.
Okay, so number 2 is a key party.
Key party.
For those who don't know what a key party is, it's something that used to happen a lot in the 70s.
In the 70s, yeah.
Yeah. And it would just be sort of a swinger thing.
It's a swinger thing. You put your keys in the bowl.
Yeah. So married couples go to a party.
You end up with somebody new.
Yeah, so at the end of the night, you pick a key, and that's how
right.
you get. So that's an awkward place to have to break up with someone, because obviously
right.
at the beginning of the night, your intention was to still be together and yet challenge your relationship in this very specific
yes.
way.
Yeah.
Which, and then I also imagine that having to leave in a huff would be very awkward as you try desperately to dig your keys out of this sort of fishbowl, probably.
Try to find your clothes.
Try to find your keys. And you're wearing bell bottoms, and that's awkward in itself.
Make sure that if you think the relationship is on thin ice, make sure that you at least have very distinctive looking keys.
Yes.
Right?
If you have any fear you're going to a key party that you'll break up, even if you had no intention of breaking up, just if you're going to a key party, distinct keys. That also allows people who really want you to find your keys.
Number two, don't do it at a key party. And that brings us to number one. Folks, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Jeff Bryant, your host for Now We're Talking, in studio with Keith Kennedy. We're counting down the top five places you don't want to break up with somebody.
Yeah.
Worst places. Number one, what is it?
International waters.
Right.
Yeah, because it's just layers and layers of bureaucracy to deal with anything that could come of this. So it's a volatile situation to break up with someone. First of all, my first fear is piracy. Maybe even not related to this, but there's a lot of piracy out
just
there.
Just generally, you're concerned
about
piracy.
And you just don't want to push someone into that world.
Right.
Because things can get pretty ugly. Also, international waters is like where party yachts exist. And I was thinking that if you're breaking up with someone, you don't want to provide them with a convenient rebound fiesta.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
And so just stay out of international waters.
Don't do it. International waters is bad. And what's the short answer?
So the short answer this week is maybe just stick with the person you're with. Maybe find a way.
Just keep it simple.
That's what they used to do, and it worked okay.
Now, Keith, that was Ask Keith Anything, everybody. Make sure if you have a question for Keith, there's multiple ways you can contact him. For this week, your challenge is find him on Twitter, @rkeithkenny. Moving along, earlier we had promised Keith we were going to give you the chance to be a football correspondent. Is that something you're still interested in?
Yes, it is.
Let's give it a shot.
Football. A game known to some as soccer, but known to everybody else as football. This week, football correspondent Keith Kennedy explains what's going on in the world of soccer. I mean, football. Euro Cup 2016, Copa America 2016. What are they, and why are they happening at the same time? Keith Kennedy explains this week on Now We're Talking.
Okay, Keith, what is going on in the world of soccer? I know there's Euro Cup. I know there's Copa. They're happening at the same time. Where are you right now? Where are you in the world of soccer?
I'm in Europe.
You're in Europe?
Yeah, I chose that. I wasn't sure where Copa was. I wasn't even sure if it was happening. So I thought, Euro 2016, that's got to be Europe.
That's amazing, man. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it is in Europe. I'm not sure. But actually, I just looked up and I see that Copa is actually happening. I think there's even a game in Seattle, so I feel like you took the long...
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's not far from...
In Seattle?
It is, yeah, and you went all the way to Europe.
I could drive to Seattle.
A lot cheaper.
This cost a fortune.
You know that I'm not able to reimburse you for the travel expenses to Europe. Do you know that?
Oh, man, I...
Oh, I'm sorry if you thought that, man. Oh.
It's fine.
I hope that doesn't undermine your experience of Euro Cup. Okay, can you tell me a bit about what's going on over there? I'm sure you've been to all the games, and you can tell us who's...
I haven't been to a game, per se. It turns out the tickets are very, very expensive.
Oh, did you spend all of your money just getting to Europe?
I may have.
Oh.
I don't know whose fault that is exactly.
So you're not able to actually go to the games because you spent all your money just kind of getting there, it sounds like.
Yeah, it might have happened. But I'm outside the games.
Okay, that's good. Keith, if you're just joining us, Keith is outside the games in Europe for Euro 2016.
Yeah.
What's happening? Who's winning the games? Who's losing the games? Can you update
teams
us?
Teams are winning, Jeff. Teams are losing.
Okay.
They take it very seriously over here, their football. I've seen drinking of joy. There's joy and a lot of tears. There's a lot of sad European people.
So it sounds like there's some teams winning. Do you know which teams are winning or who's advancing in the
I
rounds?
Know the blue team was very happy yesterday.
Okay. How do you know that?
Just a lot of them. A lot of blue people.
Okay.
Some markings on their face. Someone gave me a drink. I don't know what was in it, but it's been hard on my stomach. But they were having a blast. There's been a lot of touching. People just touch everybody. I don't think they know what the zone.
Like a personal bubble.
Space.
Yeah, I know that you kind of like having your own bubble, so I imagine that's a bit of a challenge for you.
People keep just putting their arm around me and yelling really loudly in my ear.
Wow. Well, Keith, yeah,
it's a very exciting time here.
That's amazing that you've gone all the way there. It's Euro 2016, and you know it sounds like you're having a great time. So I'm going to reflect back what I've heard so far for the audience. Keith, you're there in Europe. You're not able to go to the games because you spent all the money just getting to Europe, but you are being touched by some of the fans of some of the teams who are winning.
Yeah,
but we're not sure which teams those are. But you mentioned the color blue.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the blue team.
And white as well. Yeah.
And white as well.
Yeah.
And so where are you? You mentioned you're in Europe, but can you be more specific?
Toulouse.
Toulouse.
Yeah.
Is that in France?
I think so. I mean, that's what it said on the ticket.
Wow.
Very expensive tickets. So I guess we're all Toulouse in one way or another.
Wow, yeah, some more than others. I mean, it sounds like, I wonder if you had just stayed in Paris, if you could have used the money for the Toulouse ticket just to go to a game.
And let me do the quick math. Yes.
Okay, yeah. You know, it's funny that we didn't actually discuss this before you went on the trip because I could have probably helped you to address some of these logistical concerns.
Yeah, logistics, reimbursement, that's a lot of things.
Wow. So this is Keith again. Keith reporting. He loves football, also known as soccer, but really it's called football. And he's in Europe, and wow, 2016 and reporting live all the way from France. This is incredible. And it sounds like, Keith, like you're having the time of your life over there.
It is a time of my life, Jeff.
Wow.
It is up there for things that I have done with my time.
Keith, that's incredible. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to call in.
I agree.
Yeah, and offer some of your expert commentary on the sport of football. This has been a great segment, and I'm so glad that you could set aside some time to call us. Will you do me a favor and stay in touch while you're there and tell us what else is going on over the next few weeks?
I can do it for a little while. I have a prepaid calling card.
Oh, so how much time is left on it?
I don't know. We could be cut off at any moment, I'm guessing. That seems to be about how things go.
Okay. Oh, well, there it is. It looks like he got cut off right there, unfortunately. But hey, that's Keith. Euro Cup 2016. Thanks, Keith. We appreciate the call. So that was Keith reporting live from France. That's incredible. And Keith's back in the studio. Keith.
Hey.
Keith, you're versatile.
Yeah.
You're kind of covering all the bases here. Now, we don't have a lot of time left in the show, but if you are joining us, this is Now We're Talking. You're listening to CITR. Keith, I know that you wanted to talk about your hopes and dreams this week.
What does it mean to dream? To open your eyes wide and bravely envision a future that defies limitation. To manifest your deepest desires through the power of imagination, hope, and aspiration. This week, allow Keith Kennedy to guide you through his own journey of what it means to dream.
Keith, thank you so much for your willingness to talk about something, frankly, that's vulnerable. A lot of people, first of all, wouldn't have the courage to pursue their dreams, but to come in here like this and talk so openly, really appreciate that.
Yeah, I just meant like sleep dreams.
Oh, you mean like regular old dreams?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, we can do that.
Dream Talk with Keith. Regular old dreams. The kind that we all have when we're asleep. Dreams.
All right, Dream Talk. And so what do you got, Keith? What's your dream this week?
I was chased around my house by an alligator who had the face of Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I get to say on air, Schwarzenegger alligator.
Schwarzenegger alligator.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Look at this, a little bit of jazz music. We had a little bit of jazz there, a little bit of jazz here. Keith, it's that time. That jazz music means we're at the end of our show. What did we learn? There's a lot we learned.
Yeah.
We learned top five, top five
places to break up with
places
people.
Places
you don't
want to break with people.
Yep.
We heard about your dream.
Yep.
We heard about you, the writer.
Oh,
we heard
yeah.
from Adam Schell, who's got a book. But also we learned which buttons to press, which buttons not to press.
Yep.
Here
got
in
that.
The studio. Okay, well that's all very, very key information, I'm sure. That is good to know, right, Keith?
Yep, good learning.
Good learning. Well, folks, thanks to Keith Kennedy for being a guest this week. Thanks also to Adam Schell. Check out his book, So Does Vancouver. I'm Jeff Bryant, your host. For Now We're Talking. See you next week.